This is Voices from Appalachia Radio Show, sponsored by the Center for Appalachian Studies and Communities at Shepherd University. I'm Brian Staggers, and here's your host, Bianca Eisen.
John Brown was a 19th century abolitionist, infamous for his role in inciting a slave rebellion and raid on Harper's Ferry Armory in 1859. This incident is often referred to as one of the key events that led to the South's secession and the Civil War that followed. This Sunday, October 16th, marks the 163rd anniversary of John Brown's raid on Harper's Ferry. Michaela Barnes, a history major with an Appalachian Studies minor and a new graduate student in the 4+1 program at Shepherd University, sits down with National Historic Park Ranger Isaac Wickenheiser, who offers valuable insight on the raid and the details of what one can expect from a visit to the John Brown Museum located in Harper's Ferry, West Virginia. The museum is an interactive experience that walks visitors through John Brown's life, from before, during, and after his raid on the Federal Armory.
Why do you think that John Brown is an important historical figure?
Well, John Brown, the things that he did had a profound impact on the course of our nation here. He was a radical white abolitionist, and he would launch an attack on the Federal Armory in Harper's Ferry in an attempt to inspire enslaved people in the region to rise up and join with him and to start a campaign basically to end the institution of slavery. His attack, although ultimately a failure, helps to catapult our nation into the Civil War. John Brown, most people would say he didn't start the Civil War. And, you know, there was tension rising over the institution of slavery throughout the 1800s, but John Brown caused those tensions to boil over. And after his attack, as Frederick Douglass said, when John Brown stretched forth his arm, the sky was cleared and the time for compromises was gone.
Do you think you could tell me a little bit more about the museum itself?
Yeah, the John Brown Museum is one of several exhibits we have in the historic lower town of Harper's Ferry. The lower town is what was once the commercial heart of the town of Harper's Ferry, but is today part of our national park. And we have a variety of museums and exhibits, but the John Brown Museum is the largest. It is an exhibit with a three-part audiovisual program, which talks about history leading up to the John Brown raid, gives you sort of the context of what was going on in the world, in the United States in particular, that led John Brown to come here. And then it tells you about the raid itself, part two of the program. And then part three is the aftermath of the raid, John Brown's trial and execution, and how that feeds into the oncoming of the Civil War. But the museum itself has, in addition to the excellent film program, a lot of exhibits, artifacts related to John Brown. It's a very comprehensive look at how something like John Brown's raid came to be and what impact it had on the course of our nation.
What do you think makes the museum unique?
The story itself is quite incredible. John Brown, a white man from the North, leading a band of 16 white men, 5 African-American men, in an attack on a federal installation in Harper's Ferry. That's quite a unique story in our history, but also just the museum itself, the artifacts that we have are pretty incredible. We have the Brown family Bible on display, as well as one of the firearms, a Sharps carbine that was carried by Brown and his men, as well as an original John Brown pike, which is quite significant as well. A pike, if you're not familiar, is you can picture a broom handle with a knife on the end of it. And Brown had those made up, almost 1,000 of them, to distribute to the enslaved people who he assumed were going to spontaneously rise up and join with him. They wouldn't have had time to train those people how to use firearms, but a pike is something you can grasp pretty easily how to use that. there's complicated manuals if you want to drill down into it. But, you know, basically most people can understand that the pointy end goes at somebody else and the flat end stays toward you. But those pikes, some were acquired by other people after the raid, including Edmund Ruffin, who sent them to the governors of each slave state in America. And he said, a sample of the favors designed for use by our northern brethren. He inscribed them with that. So that pike that we have on display is not only a tangible artifact of the raid itself, but also of the boiling over of this tension that had been rising up, and how some, like Edmund Ruffin, wanted to fuel that eruption and wanted to fuel the flames of secession.
Anything else that you want to mention about the museum that we didn't get to touch on that you think people would like to know about?
The museum, I think, does a very great job of summing up the basics of John Brown and the raid, what impact it had on our country. It's well worth a visit. Also, if you can go up to the second floor, we do have some information about the African-American men who came with John Brown in a room called Allies for Freedom. Their stories are quite complex and fascinating as well.
I know we talked a bit briefly about the raid itself, but do you think you could just give us like a brief overview about the raid?
Throughout the course of his life, he had become convinced that, one, that slavery was evil, that it should be abolished, and two, that radical action was necessary to do so. It was never going to be the federal government ending slavery on its own, or enslavers themselves just deciding, yeah, this is wrong, I should free the people that I currently enslave. Brown was born in 1800 in Torrington, Connecticut. And at the time of his birth, there were just under 900,000 enslaved people in America. And from a young age, he believed that slavery was a moral evil. His parents were Calvinist. He was raised as a Calvinist. And Calvinist theology of the time taught that slavery interfered with the special relationship between man and God. So John Brown, from an early age, knew that slavery was wrong. But as time went on, as slavery continued to grow, despite being geographically segregated, the population of enslaved people continued to rise throughout his lifetime. John Brown became more and more convinced that he had to do something. He had to get involved, particularly after Nat Turner's revolt in 1831, and then also after the killing of the abolitionist editor Elijah Lovejoy in 1837. Actually, at that point, he stood up in front of a church congregation at a memorial service, and he said that he would consecrate his life to the death of slavery. So he would look for ways to get involved, first in the Underground Railroad, but then taking more radical action, particularly in the 1850s. He went to Kansas in retaliation for the deaths of anti-slavery settlers in the Kansas Territory. He and several others would commit the Pottawatomie Massacre, killing five pro-slavery settlers just in the middle of the night, leaving their bodies to be found later. In that Kansas fighting, what we call today Bleeding Kansas, Brown would lose one of his sons. His son Frederick would be killed. And after that, he would write that he must carry the war into Africa. And by Africa, he meant the U.S. slaveholding South. And in particular, he had settled in on Harper's Ferry as the perfect place to begin a campaign to end the institution of slavery. In his mind, it was the perfect place that would signal the start of his campaign. And that was the United States Armory and Arsenal, a federal gun-making factory which operated here beginning in 1800 and going up through the start of the Civil War. It was only one of two federal gun-making factories in the country, the only other being at Springfield, Massachusetts. So this is a federal gun-making factory, a prominent target, and it's in the state of Virginia, here in Harper's Ferry. Important to remember, of course, as we talk about John Brown and the raid, is that West Virginia did not exist before the Civil War. So this is a part of Virginia, the largest slaveholding state in the United States. So Brown believed that if he were to capture the armory, this nationally known significant target, that it would, in his words, be like a trumpet to rally enslaved people. He believed that they would rise up and then they would join with him. And there were thousands, about 18,000 enslaved people in the three surrounding counties around Harper's Ferry. So potentially a potent force to draw from. He thought it would send a message to the rest of the country that slavery would no longer be secure in America. Additionally, beyond that prominent symbolic target, which would announce the campaign, as he told Frederick Douglass a few years earlier, the mountains are the basis of my plan. Harper's Ferry is nestled in amongst the Blue Ridge Mountains, a part of the Appalachians. Brown believed that he could wage guerrilla warfare in the mountains. He could create strongholds, maybe tunnel networks, and they could launch raids out of the mountains further and further south, liberating enslaved people as they went. Some of those people would stay and fight with Brown. Others could move north along the mountains. The Appalachians extend the whole way south to Georgia, a deep avenue of invasion, and north they go to Maine and over the border into Canada. So you have an avenue of invasion and salvation. And Brown envisioned lightning strikes, liberating enslaved people, and eventually the entire institution of slavery would begin to topple in on itself. So Harper's Ferry was the perfect place to begin this campaign to end the institution of slavery in the largest slaveholding state in the Union, nestled in and amongst the Blue Ridge Mountains, the Appalachians, and with the prominent target to announce the beginning of the campaign. Brown would take a few years after the Kansas fighting to gather supplies, volunteers, funding, and he would then move down to the area in July of 1859, calling himself Isaac Smith. At the time, he had adopted an alias. Eventually, 21 men will volunteer to come with him. Brown, at that time, being born in 1800, is 59 years old. Most of the men who come with him are in their 20s, much younger, but they're all, like Brown, convinced that slavery has to be stopped and that radical action is necessary to do so. Clearly, the government is never going to do it. I mean, by that point, there are almost 4 million enslaved people in America. So just over John Brown's lifetime, the population had expanded almost fivefold. Brown would launch the raid on October 16th of 1859, when he felt everything was ready. They had gathered all their weapons and supplies and volunteers. He would tell his 21 men to get on their arms and proceed to the ferry. Now, they meet with initial success, and you might expect for this valuable machinery, gun-making machinery, and this huge cache of weapons, there'd be a lot of guards to protect it. But as fate would have it, there were not. Just a single armory guard facing off against John Brown and his men. They will capture the armory relatively easily. They capture prominent places in the town, bridges over the rivers, a small rifle works, John Hall's rifle works, just a little bit up the Shenandoah River from the downtown area. Things go relatively according to plan. Some of Brown's men also go out into the countryside. They capture prominent citizens as hostages and bring them back here. But things start to go very wrong the morning of October 17th. Rather than large numbers of enslaved people in the area spontaneously rising up and joining with him, you instead have members of the local white population taking up arms and fighting back against Brown and his men. And very quickly, the situation goes from bad to worse to a nightmare. It spirals out of control for John Brown and his men. They end up retreating, taking refuge in a small red brick building, the armory, fire engine, and guardhouse. They barricade the doors and they attempt to hold out throughout the day on October 17th. But their position quickly becomes hopeless. Resistance by local townspeople during the day on October 17th goes from a few isolated individuals to a few dozen to a few hundred. And by the late afternoon of October 17th, there are probably as many as 1,000 armed men surrounding the armory grounds. And they are bolstered late in the day by United States Marines who are sent from the nation's capital. Word had reached Washington, D.C., that the armory was under attack, that there was some sort of slave revolt in progress. There were rumors that there were hundreds of enslaved people pillaging and murdering throughout the countryside, wild rumors and reports of what was going on. They had reached Washington, D.C., and the president at the time, James Buchanan, would dispatch federal soldiers to put an end to the raid. The only ones on hand, though, as fate would have it, are the United States Marines quartered at a barracks near the Navy Yard. The closest Army detachment is down near Fort Monroe. So it's the Marines who are sent, but Buchanan wants an experienced officer who he trusts, who has been in combat before and is of sufficient rank for this, what could be a delicate military situation. So on hand in Washington happens to be Lieutenant Colonel Robert E. Lee, serving in the Army at the time, but on hand to settle his father-in-law's estate at Arlington. And Buchanan will choose Lieutenant Colonel Robert E. Lee to put down the raid. And he's assisted, coincidentally enough, by Jeb Stuart, the lieutenant at the time, who just happened to be on hand in the War Department when reports were coming in of the Harper's Ferry action. They will head to Harper's Ferry, get there overnight. The next morning, the Marines storm the fire engine and guardhouse, taking John Brown, a few of his remaining men, prisoner. And the whole event comes to an end after about 36 hours. Brown never gets out of the town of Harper's Ferry. Once he gets in, they do not free more than a handful of people directly and permanently. The only people who are actually freed by John Brown and his men are the family of Isaac Gilbert, wife Sarah, and their children. They, at the time, were the property of the town mayor, Fontaine Beckham. And Beckham had put in his will that upon his death, they were to be freed. There are four local townspeople who are killed, and Fontaine Beckham is one of them. So the family of Isaac Gilbert is free because of John Brown's actions, but essentially no one else. It appeared in the immediate aftermath, all they had caused is bloodshed. Four townspeople have been killed, three enslaved people die, one Marine in the final action in the engine house, and 10 of Brown's men out of the 21 are killed or mortally wounded. So there is death and destruction, but very little else. Brown himself would be wounded, but would not be killed during the raid and would recover enough to stand trial the next week, starting on October 25th. And his trial would ignite a firestorm of controversy throughout the nation. And it really consumes the nation heading into 1860. Brown's trial is actually very brief. We're used to high-profile trials today, taking a very long time, months to begin, months to impanel a jury, months to reach an end of the witness testimony and for the jury to deliberate, and finally a judge to deliver a verdict. But John Brown's trial would last 5 days. He's brought before a judge on October 25th. On October 30th, the jury deliberates. And on November 2nd, just a week after it began, the judge will render his sentence of death by hanging. The jury found him guilty of murder, treason, and inciting slave rebellion. And he would be executed on December 2nd, 1 month after sentencing, only really 6 weeks after the raid. The controversy that he had ignited did not die with him, and it engulfed the nation in 1860. Major political parties fractured in the wake of John Brown's raid and his sensational trial. The Republican Party, instead of going with who everyone assumed would be their candidate for president, William Seward, they went for a less well-known figure in Abraham Lincoln because they felt that William Seward had expressed views that were too radical concerning the institution of slavery. So it's in part because of John Brown's raid that Lincoln is the nominee for president. The Democratic Party fractures. They head to their nominating convention, and there are two camps which develop and which only harden over the course of their convention. One camp, more pro-Southern, pro-slavery, feels that John Brown's raid, it's evidence that they need a constitutional guarantee for the institution of slavery, a 13th Amendment, which will guarantee slavery in perpetuity. But the other camp, more moderate, more Northern, they're in border states, they're in big cities in the North, and they feel that an amendment protecting slavery that's too radical, their constituents won't support that. So popular sovereignty is still the way to go. These two sides, they don't back down, and they nominate separate candidates. Stephen Douglas for the more moderate side, popular sovereignty platform, and then John Breckinridge for the pro-slavery 13th Amendment guaranteeing slavery platform. And both are on the ballot in 1860. So you have an election where there's two Democratic candidates in addition to a Republican candidate, in addition to a third party candidate, John Bell, running on behalf of the Constitutional Union Party, whose stance on slavery was that they had no stance on slavery. They didn't mention it at all, trying to thread the needle down the middle. Doesn't work particularly well, but it siphons off further votes from the Democratic Party and paves the way for Abraham Lincoln to win the White House, which spawns the secession crisis and eventually the Civil War.
Do you think that all of those lasting impacts are the reason why we still celebrate the raid today and have anniversaries to remember it?
Yeah, I believe so. It's why we commemorate the raid each year. We have a historical company, United States Marine Historical Company, comes out normal times. We did have to cancel it for 2 years for COVID, of course. But it had a profound impact on the course of our nation. And that's worth studying in and of itself, the myriad impacts it had. But it's also worth reflecting on. John Brown, he gets to some of the essential contradictions of American society. You know, we talk about protest, especially protests for racial justice today, and talk about the nature of violent protest. And, you know, John Brown, that was a violent protest against the institution of slavery. But can you justify what John Brown did? John Brown killed or helped kill many people, particularly in Kansas, but also in Harper's Ferry. Can you justify what he did because he wanted to end slavery? Few people today would argue that slavery was good or that it should have gone on. But can you show the value of life by if you're willing to take life? And it's something we still wrestle with today, and particularly is with the issue of capital punishment. You know, does that serve the ends of justice? If you think killing is wrong and you want to punish someone for that by killing them, how does that make sense? Can we make sense of it? For John Brown's part, he felt justified. He felt that what he did had to be done in order to shake the nation, to rouse the nation, as he said. And he questioned, you know, what was justice? At his trial, he was provided an allocution at the end, right before the sentencing. He could speak on his own behalf as to why sentence should not be imposed upon him. And he spoke about sort of how he felt more justified in what he did. And the real people on trial were Virginia and the nation for allowing the institution of slavery to go on.
If you have anything else that you want to mention that we didn't touch on, or anything else that you want to say about the park system as a whole.
I'd encourage everybody to come visit Harper's Ferry. Our National Historical Park is incredibly diverse. There's a lot of history here. We talked about John Brown extensively, but there are Civil War battles that occur here. There are early civil rights groups who come here as well. The National League of Colored Women and the Niagara Movement both come here around the turn of the 20th century. We've got important industrial history, a lot of history. Even if folks aren't really that interested in history, we have a beautiful park with over 20 miles of hiking trails, which are great for recreation. Some of the trails are quite easy, a few hundred yards or a mile. And some of the other trails are quite difficult, but lead you to spectacular overlooks. So I think we have something to offer everyone here in Harper's Ferry. This weekend will be our event with the United States Marine Historical Company. It's really excellent. They do a great job. And I'd encourage everyone who can to attend. It'll be from 11 a.m. to 4 p.m.
That was Shepherd University Michaela Barnes interviewing National Historic Park Ranger Isaac Wickenheiser. Harper's Ferry National Park will be hosting a presentation with the Marine Corps Historical Company called At All Times Ready, today and tomorrow from 1 to 3 p.m. And staff from the Marine Corps Historical Company will be at John Brown's Fort in Harper's Ferry from 11 a.m. to 4 p.m. to educate visitors. You can learn more about the history of Harper's Ferry by visiting the National Park Service's website at nps.gov. Today's episode was inspired by Dr. John Steffen, who serves as the chair of the biology department at Shepherd University. He's a drummer in the band he and his brother formed, Steffen Wolf. I sat down with Dr. Steffen to talk about his band's inspiration for their song, The New John Brown.
My twin brother and I had finished reading several books about John Brown. Most recently, we both finished reading a book by James McBride called The Good Lord Bird that is now made into a movie. But it shows John Brown's life leading up to the events at Harper's Ferry, and we were really moved by it. We really related to the anger that he felt about the way that African Americans were treated and slavery. And at the same time, there were events happening in our own country, George Floyd being killed, a bunch of other racial events that have led to the development of Black Lives Matter. And so we had both sort of finished reading this book, The Good Lord Bird, at about the same time that all this racial stuff was coming up again. And so my brother wrote the song, but he wrote it from the perspective of John Brown wanting to create equality for African Americans.
Well, my name is John Brown, and it's time I come around. Well, my name is John Brown, and it's time I come around. They say
The New John Brown by the band Stephen Wolf. You can learn more about the band by visiting their website at stephenwolfmusic.com. Thank you all so much for joining me, and until next week, I'm Bianca Eisen.
Voices from Appalachia Radio Show is sponsored by the Center for Appalachian Studies and Communities at Shepherd University. With the following created to enhance and develop the cultural and economic life of West Virginia and the Appalachian region. Academic programs that include an Appalachian Studies minor, an interdisciplinary BA, BS undergraduate degree, and a graduate certificate and master's degree in Appalachian Studies at Shepherd University. Celtic Roots and Global Appalachia Study Abroad and Celtic Heritage Series. The Appalachian Heritage Writers in Residence and Writers Award, which support the West Virginia Center for the Books, One Book, One West Virginia Common Read Selection. The West Virginia Fiction Competition, the Anthology of Appalachian Writers, an annual anthology featuring writing by the Heritage Writer, and poetry, fiction, creative nonfiction, essays, and photography created by Appalachian writers across the region and the world. Voices from the Misty Mountains, NEH, and West Virginia Humanities Council Teacher Institutes, Shepherd Speaks StoryCorps Project, and this radio show, in cooperation with Shepherd University Public Radio Station, WSHC-FM. To learn more about our degree programs or upcoming events, visit us at our website at shepherd.edu/appalachian or at our Facebook page, Appalachian Studies Program at Shepherd.